Good evening. I'm Alan Bernstein. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
and thank you for having me back. It's good to be here again. It's been a while, but it's good to be here. And let's just get this out of the way. I spoke at Bellflower last Saturday night, and it did not occur to me that there was some overlap. So if you heard me, I don't know, go to your happy place. And and the 44 minutes remaining will be over before you know it. I have one story. I'll try and pull out different attributes, but there. At least I've done a 10-step. I've acknowledged it, and I love this meeting place. There's a lot of enthusiasm here. If you're new, what to me that means is that I think there are two ways to practice AA. One is begrudgingly, sort of like condemned men and women, and one is to acknowledge that we are sort of condemned men and women, and to embrace it and to practice it with enthusiasm. It may seem like a subtle difference, because if you're new, it's possible. It just seems like it's all over no matter what. I can relate to that, but this is a good place to be. And I'm going to say this. These tiles, there's one tile here that has been here for a while, and it moves me. I have three children, and in sort of alcoholic fashion. Oh, and before I get any further, welcome to the new people. And Julia, thank you, wherever you are, for your 10 minutes. It was really wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Thank you. I have three children in sort of alcoholic fashion. They are a total of 21 months apart. So literally, I had three kids under the age of two at one point, I didn't lie, because you've taught me not to lie, but when they were all under two, I would only acknowledge they were all under three. Because that sounded dramatic, like I've got three babies under three, but under two just sounded pathetic. Like had you never met a calendar, or, you know, And now they're literally all in puberty, and God grant me the serenity. But you know, it is not my job to diagnose anybody. But my daughter Naomi, my children are lovely. My daughter Naomi really seems like she needs a drink, and she does. And there's this thing right here for Naomi B. And honestly, if you knew her, it's like her favorite colors, and it's from a woman who got sober in 1980, but it reminds me that part of our job in Alcoholics Anonymous is to leave Alcoholics Anonymous here for the next people who need it. And it fills me, because honestly, if you have children, I mean, there are children here, many of you do have children, there is a sort of terror when they hit puberty, like, whoa, like, there's a lot of life out there, and there's a refuge here for those of us who need it. And so I feel in a way like my job is to try and carry on the traditions and respect our singleness of purpose, and hopefully that if Naomi loves her first drink as much as I suspect she will, if she wants a seat someday, it'll be here for her to claim it. And let's see, I am sober. My sobriety date is April 16th of 1990. I have a home group, the Pacific Group. I have a sponsor, Clancy I. And interestingly enough, in a week, he will be turning 90. And it turns out that I asked him to sponsor me on his birthday. I'd like to think that was a birthday present. I don't know that he would agree. So we will have been together, as it were, for 18 years come next Sunday, which is a good run. It's been very good for me. I was born in New York, in Brooklyn, which Brooklyn is now very hip and very cool. That was honestly the last hip, cool thing I did, being born in Brooklyn. And I didn't plan it, but I will take credit for it. And my dad was in the Army when I was born, and then he worked for IBM, and we moved around a bit. I wound up growing up in the Midwest in a lovely, leafy suburb, in Elmhurst, Illinois, a Chicago suburb. The only problem with Elmhurst was that I lived there, and my discomfort and alcoholism. We moved there when I was 10, and I had a bushy red afro. We called it an Isro, and I had a New York accent. I had a bit of a speech impediment. I was exactly, you know, the kid you want to be when you're a 10-year-old boy. And it turned out that there is a superstition among the German people, and there were a lot of Germans in Elmhurst. And the superstition was that if you rub a redhead, it will bring you good luck. So if you can imagine going into puberty with a big, bushy, red Israel and an East Coast accent while living in the Midwest, and going to the Jewel to go grocery shopping with your mom. I have two brothers, neither of whom have red hair, and random women just sort of walking up to you and rubbing your hair. The point is, I needed a drink. And I did. I was uncomfortable, and it could not come soon enough. I first started drinking. This is so, I don't know why it's funny to me, but it was, I learned a lot from my early drinking, and it was this. We used to go to services. I'm Jewish. We used to go to services on Friday night, and at the end of Jewish services, if you've never been to one, it's traditional to break bread. You bless the bread, and you bless the wine. It's sort of like a tradition, and the moms would pour out these little shot glasses of Manischewitz wine, which, I mean, I've not had wine in 27 years, but this is my recollection. It's like wine scientifically formulated to appeal to a 12-year-old. It's super sweet. I mean, it has an alcohol content, but it's mostly just like condensed grape juice with some alcohol content. And because they were moms, they would overpour like crazy. There would be dozens of extra shots. And so service, we all had to go to services. That was what it was like back then. And then we'd go and we'd bless the bread and bless the wine. And then the adults would retire down to the reception hall to have cookies and punch. And they would leave dozens of these shots of Manischewitz behind. And this is really how my mind works. I took that as an invitation. I took that as permission and an invitation. And we started having shot contests. And I was really good at downing shots of Manischewitz wine. And what I learned from that was, because then we would go down to the reception hall, and what I learned is you just had to remember to be polite to the rabbi. That, like, you know, that it was permissible to get drunk as long as you didn't draw attention to yourself. And that is a lesson that I carried through my drinking, was that you can get really drunk, but just don't be rude. Don't be offensive. Don't draw attention. And the reason why I say that is because when I got to the end of my drinking, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I discovered was I really wanted to be drunk. I did not want anything to stop it. And I realize now that institutionalization is a crude but at times effective way of getting stopped. I drank myself under the table, and I try to be as polite as I could. I'm going to. If you have a history of getting arrested for drunk driving, you are going to probably resent me if you don't already. After I share this, but in the 80s, you didn't really get arrested for drunk driving. It didn't mean you didn't get pulled over. I got pulled over fairly regularly for drunk driving. I just would be like, "Yes, officer, I did have a little bit to drink," or I think I would say things like, "Yes, officer, I kind of had a little bit too much. I think I had 3 beers tonight," and you know, and. But I said it politely, and they'd be like, "Son, do you want us to give you a ride home? Do you want us to follow you?" I'm going to be like, "Well, no, officer, you can if you want to, but I don't think it's necessary. I'll drive home now, sir." And, you know, that doesn't really work anymore. But back then, it worked. I went off to college. I went to college in North Carolina. And we had mostly drunk hard liquor. It was not easy being a high school drinker in Illinois back then to get anything. And so when we could get stuff, we would get like 151 and Everclear, really high proof stuff. That's what I started off with. And then I got to college in the South in the 1980s. And it was easy to get beer. There was always a keg being tapped somewhere. I'm a Southern frat boy, which is an odd little part of my story. But if you're a Southern frat boy, woo. And I fell madly in love with beer. My beer of choice was Budweiser. It is the king of beers. Yeah, yay. And I loved Bud Longnecks back then, but what I really loved were pitchers and kegs. I just like, I'm not a quality drinker, I'm a quantity drinker. And loved like a big red plastic cup full of keg beer. And if you had friends, what you all would sort of do is top off each other's beer before it hit the bottom. And if you worked it right, you could really kind of have a credible claim that you were just having one drink all night. And it could be 100 ounces, but it was a beer. And I drank for the effect. And when I was in college, I really was sort of more or less insanely drunk all the time. But I really had two addictions, if you would. One was the beer, and the other was adrenaline. I realize now what I sort of loved was the feeling of kind of coming to at 9:45 on a Tuesday morning and realizing I had a final at 3 o'clock. I had a paper due by 5, and you know, and that manic, like, I'm going to get it done, and you know, and getting it done. And my favorite thing, I'm a small, petty person. I'm better now after 27 years of sobriety. I really liked doing better than people who were goodies, who had, like, respected the rules and worked hard and studied hard and had a plan and flashcards and all that. And it made my dark little heart happy if I did better than them. And mostly it distracted me from myself. And that's really what it was about. The drinking, the adrenaline, I could not handle being myself. And look, let's be clear. I've heard your stories for over a quarter of a century. There are people in AA who have had unspeakable things happen to them. And if you are one of them, part of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that through sobriety and through the steps, people find a level of comfort, a level of dignity, a level of joy. Like, that's all there. But what's my story? I suffered being raised in suburbia by parents who stayed married and gave their kids a good education even when money was tight. Like, it wasn't really that hard to be me. I mean, I did have, like, the big hair, the bushy red hair, and that was pretty bad. But honestly, even that all went away eventually. But the point was, it was me. It was me waking up every day in this life, incredibly uncomfortable in my own skin, with a loud, angry head just kind of always going off, telling me all of my defects of character, and I really needed to drink. I got through college, and I sort of realized in March of my senior year that I had failed to either apply for any jobs or to apply to grad school, which really were sort of the two things that you do when you're a senior in college. And I really did not want to go back to Chicago and work again at Marshall Field selling sheets and bedding. And so I found a way to find a job interview. I charmed my way in to getting the interview. I BS'd my way through it. I got flown up to New York, and they gave me a job on Wall Street. And the truth is, it was an amazing opportunity, but all I really used it for was to explore the dive bars of Manhattan. I would show up at work late. I didn't even know that you really probably shouldn't tell people when you show up late at work, "I'm sorry, I'm late, I was hungover." Like, you're actually, I think, supposed to lie about that. But for some reason, I'm like, "Oh, I'll tell the truth." And the thing was, in the 80s, they needed bodies on Wall Street. Everything was booming back then, and they needed bodies, and I was a body, and I wasn't really going to be competition for promotions or bonuses. So they put up with me, and at 5 o'clock, we were done, and I was out of that suit and into, like, old jeans and ratty Oxford shirts, and just doing a pub crawl of all the dive bars. And you don't have to love dive bars to be an alcoholic, but I'm just going to guess that a few of you are my people. And I loved dive bars. Like, the dingier and darker, the better. I was all over the East Village back then. There was the Lithuanian bars and the Ukrainian bars, and there was this horseshoe-shaped bar at 7th and B where they filmed a scene from Crocodile Dundee. And at 2nd and B, there was a gas station that had been turned into a bar, and it was, like, all magical to me. And I had my favorite bar of all, and that was the Village Idiot. And it was dark and dank. There were junkies shooting up in the bathroom. There were parolees violating with concealed weapons. And I'm like, yes, this is real. And I moved in. And I I moved in. There was a jukebox with a lot of sad songs, and when I drink, I love sad music. It complements my melancholy, and a lot of I don't know if you all, you're young people, I don't know if you'll get these references, but there was like a lot of Patsy Cline on the jukebox, and there was that Band of Gold song about the woman whose husband leaves her on their wedding night, and there was my favorite of all song, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, What a Good Wife You'd Be. And I loved it. I want to be clear. My story is mostly a drinking story. If you're newer, I'm aware that you may have done drugs. I didn't. Except during this period, I did smoke a little bit of recreational crack. It was the 80s in New York, and who didn't? What I want to say is this. I suffer from alcoholism, and the way that I primarily medicated my alcoholism was with alcohol, but it has been my observation that recreational drugs don't seem to be a very effective way of medicating alcoholism. So, if you've wound up in AA and you're an alcoholic, whatever your history is, I'm really glad you're here. And I think for all alcoholics, there's a solution. I think our singleness of purpose is very important, but I don't think singleness of purpose means that we didn't do a lot of other adventures in order to arrive here. And I found as I drank in New York that the pub crawl became overwhelming. And I don't know if anyone can relate to this, but my experience is that I just get more and more exhausted the longer I drink. And when I started, it was an adventure to have like a wallet full of cash and just go from bar to bar. And eventually just going to new places becomes overwhelming, and I don't really want to meet new people, and I'm a little afraid of new situations. And so for the last 2 years of my drinking, I really pretty much moved into the idiot, and I just was there all the time. And what I want to tell you is this. It was the people at the Village Idiot were barflies. They really were. But this is what I know about alcoholism. I was years sober. I mean this sincerely. I was years sober before I realized I was a barfly. And I'm telling you, you could have sent mail to me at the Village Idiot, and the bartender, Fat Tommy, would have gotten it to me. But I didn't realize I was a barfly. I really thought, because I had this like college degree and I'd worked on Wall Street, I had created this fantasy that I was enrolled in some cultural anthropology program, and I believed I was an undercover cultural anthropologist, that I was in the idiot, but not of the idiot, that I was studying. I knew those people were barflies, and I am telling you, I was years sober before it suddenly hit me. Dude, you were a barfly. Like, nobody would have walked through the door of that bar while you were there and looked down that long, dark, narrow bar and said, wow, look at those poor lost souls and Alan B., our undercover cultural anthropologist. Would not have happened. But that's what alcoholism tells my mind. It tells me that I'm different. And it tells me that I'm special for, really, in hindsight, for all the wrong reasons. And I'm there. And finally, the drinking stopped working. And that was kind of awful. It was, I want to tell you, I was pretty much drunk for about a decade. And there was always a price to pay. You know that. You're my people. You know that. But it was always worth paying the price. I did not care. I didn't like hangovers. I didn't like humiliation. I didn't like degradation. I didn't like fear. Like, I didn't like those things. But, that's just what you put up with if you're going to drink. Like, that's what you deal with in my experience. And it was absolutely worth it in order to drink. This is what I can tell you about the kind of drinker I am. I lived in Manhattan, as I've said, and this bar was around 11th and 1st, and I lived at 40th and 2nd, and that's 30 blocks. And 30 blocks, when you're drunk at 4 in the morning, is a long way to walk. And every night when I went out to drink, I would put a bus token in my pocket because I had some hope that if I put a bus token in, I would not find a way to spend it. And at the end of the night when I needed to get home, I'd be able to take a bus. And I can tell you, I almost never at the end of the night had a bus token. Because when I need the next drink, I'm going to do, say, be whatever I need to be in order to get it. That's just my experience. And one night, it stopped working. And in our literature, Bill Wilson, our founder, in the Big Book, talks about a white light experience, sort of an overwhelming sense of the presence of God coming into his life. And I had the opposite, for what it's worth. I had a dark light moment. I had this moment where even in a dark bar, it seemed like it got darker. And I had a moment of clarity of how separated I was from everyone. I could really see the space separating me from all the other people in the bar. And I saw people in that bar in that moment holding hands, and it seemed to me that I could see that there were molecules that were separating their hands from really being connected to each other. And I think that I'd been drunk for a long time to avoid what a lonely person I was. And in that moment, the curtain fell, and what I got was I was alone. I had pushed my family away. I had pushed my friends away. If you cared about me, I could not stand it. For a long time, I was the kind of person who, if you assaulted me directly, I could deal with it pretty well, a full frontal effect assault. But if you looked at me with concern and pity, that destroyed me. I had no defense against that. And my family is looking at me with confusion and concern, and I need them gone because that's too painful. And I'm alone, but I've been able to drink it away, and suddenly there's this moment, and I get that I am always going to be alone, that I am cut off from humanity, and that's never going to change. And bizarrely, the drinking stopped working. And that was like being abandoned by a lover, and I didn't know what to do. And that was probably early February of 1990. I tried a brief experiment to control drinking. I don't know why. I thought maybe that would work, but I did. I set out to drink 2 drinks a day, and that's hell. Oh my God. Like, I do not wish control drinking on an enemy. Here's what you get: the beer, and you take a sip, and now I know that 10 minutes has to go by about before I can take the next sip. So I'm waiting for the 10 minutes to go by. And it's a bar, and so you're talking, and it's like Charlie Brown's teacher from the old Peanuts cartoons. Wah, 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 and I just want to rip your tongue out. And the 10 minutes finally goes by, and I can take the sip, and then I discover that it does nothing except reset the clock for another 10 minutes. It's a nightmare. The flip side is it actually may have been a very effective way of learning what my relationship is with drinking, because it's awful. And after about 2 weeks, thank God, I just wildly overshot the mark. And yet it didn't really turn off my head, which is what it had always been the one thing that I could count on alcohol to do. And so I turned to my next plan. It was the end of February. It was Mardi Gras. I'd grown up in Chicago, in New York, big Catholic communities, and all I knew was that Lent was starting the next day, and I decided I was going to give up drinking for Lent. And I'm Jewish. We're not known for our Lenten practice, but it was the best I could do, and I white-knuckled it through 40 long days and even longer nights of Lent. And on Easter Sunday, I wound up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a woman spoke. I could not remember a word she said. I remember the meeting was called High Noon, which I will give myself credit. What a great place to surrender. I surrendered at High Noon. And and I met somebody who I'd known from out and about. I didn't know they were in AA. She took me out for lunch, and she told me a little bit about her alcoholism. And I do remember having a moment of identification. And then I went to an Easter dinner at a friend's parents' house, and I had half a glass of white wine and half a glass of red wine. I had committed to being sober for Lent. Lent was over. And what I can tell you is this. I remember standing at the train station waiting for the train to take us back into the city after that dinner, and I remember how tired I felt. I was 25, and I was bone tired. I'm a single parent. I raised those 3 kids. I raised them on my own, so I know tired. I had 3 children in diapers under the age of 2. I know tired, and I'm not kidding. I don't remember ever feeling as bone tired as on that night, Easter of 1990, waiting for that train to go in to the city, because I knew what the next indicated action was. The next indicated action was to go on a huge bender. I knew it. And I turned myself back into you the next day, and that was April 16th of 1990. And one day at a time, ever since then, I have been sober from everything, and I am grateful for that. I truly understand that I did have a relapse, that I went to a meeting, and that I made a decision to drink. And I also know that God gave me a huge gift. By the way, that's how I view it. If you're new and this God thing is overwhelming, we do ask you to believe in something bigger than yourself, and I think that's important. For me, that's God. And if I talk about it that way and that rubs you the wrong way, please just substitute whatever you need to substitute to make it work for you. But I think that was the intervention of a loving God, because it is not characteristic of my drinking that I have half a glass of white wine and half a glass of red wine, and then I stay sober for over a quarter of a century. I think that was a gift. And I think, like any gift, I can throw it away, but I don't have any expectation that it will come back that easily. And I arrived in AA, and I was young, and I was angry in no small measure, because you were very clear that you expected me not to drink. And I didn't know how to function without drinking. I had been drunk for a long time, and I didn't know how to deal with people, and you wanted me to deal with people. I felt that I could have handled one or two of you at a time, but this was really overwhelming. I sat on the aisle every meeting for the first month or two of sobriety, because I was really scared that I was going to get nauseous, because I felt so anxious all the time. And I didn't know whether I wanted to go on or not. I got a bike 3 or 4 days before I got sober in New York. And I do not mean like a cool vroom vroom Harley. I mean like dun 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 dun. And I like biked around Manhattan for the first couple of years of my sobriety. But in those early weeks, I had a real bike problem. I kept on getting hit by things. I got hit by a van. I got hit by a cab door. I like went into a pothole. At least one time, to the best of my recollection, I just sort of spontaneously went over my own handlebars.
Oh my God.
And I'll tell you this, I didn't wear a helmet. Because you may not have discerned this, but let me tell you, I am super tough in my head. And I thought helmets were for wusses. So I'm biking around. What I like to do when I bike around the island of Manhattan, by the way, as a newcomer, I like to have arguments with you. I don't really like to argue with you in person, because you have a chance of winning then. But I've learned that if I argue with you in my head, if you start to get an advantage, I can wind the argument back up and come back with an even better response. So that's my thing. I bike around the island of Manhattan. I argue with people in my head, and I don't wear a helmet. And I'm brand new in AA, and I keep getting hit by things. And at about 5 weeks of sobriety, I have this moment of clarity. I really do. And it's that I in part, am riding the way that I'm riding and having the experiences that I'm having, because I don't care. I don't care what happens. I am sober. I am hanging by a thread. And in our literature, and I'm not the one who's going to give you a huge step study up here and tell you a lot about the literature, but I'm going to recommend it because it's a great source, and I'm going to recommend that you might approach it with a sponsor. Those are just some suggestions for fun and for free, whatever they're worth. But what it says in our literature is that the alcoholic who arrives in AA is faced with the dilemma of choosing between certain physical death and living life on spiritual terms. And it's maybe my favorite little thing, because it's saying that we are people who don't know, given the option of dying or having a loving God work in our life, what the right answer is. That's me, and I think it's probably some of you, and I love that. I love it in part because, and I have great fondness and respect for our Al-Anons. That's a great program, but I imagine the Al-Anon, this is my head, that the Al-Anon newcomer like highlights this part, and they bring it to their sponsor, and they're like, wait, is this really saying what I'm thinking it's saying, that this fool that I love can't figure out whether death or God, like what the right answer, like I've been loving them and worrying about them, and that, and like, yeah, that's exactly who I was. I didn't know what I wanted, except that on that day when I had that realization about the bike and the accident, I think what you had done for me, through your love, through your honesty, through your willingness to reach out, I don't think you had convinced me overwhelmingly, but I think you'd help me shift to be like 51-49 in favor of staying around and staying alive. I don't think it was a big difference. I will say this, in the third step in our 12 and 12, it talks about faith and willingness. It says faith is like a door and willingness is the key. And if you have the least amount of willingness, it's like this locked door is magically opened. And I think that's what I experienced that day. I had just a little bit of willingness, a little bit more willingness to go on than to quit, and I bought a helmet. And I don't know how what it is about the delivery. People always laugh when I say that, and I love our laughter. Like, laugh away, I mean it. But I stopped having accidents immediately, and I immediately stopped having accidents when I got that helmet. And this is what I want to tell you. I love our 11-step. Our 11-step challenges us to work on developing a bigger relationship with our higher power through prayer and meditation. I love it. I recommend it highly. And I'll for whatever it's worth, I think that I've actually gotten pretty good at meditation, and I didn't get good at meditation until I accepted that nobody is perfect at meditation, that it's not accounting. Like, you can't make the numbers all add up and just go, yeah, they add up, I must be done. It's not like reconciling a checkbook. But it's a practice, and I have practiced it slowly and haltingly, and I've gotten comfortable with it. And what I believe to this day is that prayer is great, but if I can tie my prayer to an action, I seem to get a much quicker response from my higher power. And that helmet, it was like a sign that I was willing to surrender a little bit here and wanted to stick around. And it was like magic. I stopped having accidents. I got a little more active. I wrote a four-step for literally the dumbest reason I've ever heard anyone write a four-step. I was a few months sober, and I was wearing that helmet, but I was riding that bike into sketchier neighborhoods later at night, and I knew that I was in trouble. And I did something that is counterintuitive. I'm the son of a military intelligence officer. I believe that information is power. I believe that what you do with information is you do not share information. That you keep it to yourself, it gives you leverage and power. That is what my experience in life had taught me. And I lived in a family and grew up in a family that was loving in many ways, but there was not a lot of advantage to volunteering stuff. And so this whole thing in AA, you're as sick as your secrets, that was challenging for me. Like, and I had to sort of just, okay, I'll try that. It feels a little weird. It feels a little unsafe. I don't really like being vulnerable. I'd rather kind of just solve it and then come back and tell you a pithy little story about how I solved it. But on that night when I realized I was in trouble and riding that bike into bad neighborhoods, I raised my hand in a meeting, and when I was called on, I shared what was going on. And there was this woman, Karen W., who had 5 years of sobriety, and she had moved from L.A. to New York to be the vixen on one of the soap operas, and she looked like a goddess, blonde hair, blue eyes. She had the best rack in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1990, and there's power there, and she swore like a truck driver, and she called me. She had my phone number, and this is before cell phones, so I'm like home, and it's like ring, ring, and it was Karen, and she so bossy, and it was like scary and a little exciting, and she made me go get my big book, and she explained to me how to write an inventory, and so I immediately concluded that there was a celebrity outreach program in AA, and that if I pleased her, I'd have a cool celebrity friend. I believed that, and that is a really, really dumb reason to write your inventory. I'm going to tell you a little secret right now. It didn't matter. It was a good action. If I'm an alcoholic and I'm an AA and I need to write the steps, it doesn't matter why I take the good action. It just matters that I take it. And so I wrote my inventory, and God apparently does not care that I did it for a really goofy reason, because I got all the benefits that I think I needed to get from doing it. And I shared it with her, and what I expected was that if I did it right, because I am a little bit dramatic, I thought that like the roof of the apartment building would blow off, like in Ghostbusters at the end of the movie, and that the glory of God would rain in triumphant upon us because I had shared my inventory. And that didn't happen, and I was a little underwhelmed, and I went back to my apartment, back to my apartment, and there's that thing in the book where it tells us now we spend an hour like considering the bricks and the mortar, and it's just like nothing. It's like two paragraphs in the book, and so I go back to do it, and I'm going to share. Lately, I've been sharing this, and it feels incredibly liberating. For years, I still don't know. I think I might have fallen asleep during that hour. It's a lot. Like you have this inventory, and you read it, and then like you're back in your bed thinking about the bricks and the mortar, and there's nothing in there that tells you what you do if you screw up that hour. Like, you know, there's like no, like, you're supposed to spend an hour and then you're supposed to be done. And And here's what I can tell you. For years, it worried me that I had done it wrong. And now, what I can tell you at 27 years of sobriety is I don't understand God perfectly. I don't think I'm ever going to understand God perfectly, but I understand God better than I did when I was a newcomer. And God's actions sometimes upset me and confuse me. Bad things happen. People get hurt. People die. Like, bad things happen, and that's part of God's path. But God is not petty. You'd have to be a really petty person. I was a really petty person. I was the kind of person who believed that falling asleep during the sixth and seventh step after doing a sincere fourth and fifth step could somehow or other invalidate the whole thing. But God, as I understand God today, God's not petty. God loves me more than that. And I went on with my life. I moved out to California when I was 3.5 years sober, and I immediately screwed up. Those people in New York had taught me good basic AA, the kind of things that I think you probably learn here. And I know that many of you are affiliated with other really active meetings around this part of LA County, and you will learn those things that I learned. And I got to LA and I decided I was ready to graduate into like advanced placement Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't exist, so I was happy to kind of create the course syllabus. I knew that it didn't require as much chair stacking and coffee pot cleaning. It was going to be more spiritual. And those were my decisions, and I was still on our lifeboat, but I moved myself from the center of the AA lifeboat, which, by the way, is where I would suggest we want to find ourselves, to the edge of the lifeboat. And on the edge of the lifeboat, I was with the people who were on the edge of the lifeboat, and the seas would swell up from time to time during storms, and people would get swept overboard. And that's what happens on the edge of the lifeboat in Alcoholics Anonymous. But here's what I can tell you. At a certain point, I realized I didn't really like the edge of the lifeboat, and I wanted to get back to the center, and I didn't know where it was. I'm not kidding. I didn't know where it was, and at that moment, I knew that I was on my way to getting drunk. I knew it. And I was sort of bummed because AA had been something very good for me for a number of years, and then I'd made a bunch of bad choices and moved myself away from it, and I was lost. And then again, I did something that is not my instinctive nature, but that I recommend if you're in a bad situation. I shared about it. I told the truth, that I was on my way out. And this guy came up to me, and what he said was great. He goes, "I believe you." I was 8 years sober. He goes, "I believe you, Alan." He goes, "But honestly, have you not noticed after 8 years that everyone who gets loaded comes back? Not everyone sticks around. I'm going to be honest with you. Not everyone sticks around, but everyone comes back." He goes, "If you're getting ready to be a newcomer anyway, why don't you just start acting like a newcomer now? Why wait?" And it was like magic. It was this magical permission to go back to the very basic things that I had worked. And, you know, I'm 27 years sober. I'm a grown-up. I drive a minivan. I was just secretary of my home group, the Pacific Group. I am like a grown-up, and I can tell you this. My life has gotten bigger, and probably some of my insights have gotten a little bit more profound, but the fundamentals of AA have not changed at all in the 27 years that I've been here, one day at a time. I need to not drink. I need to have a sponsor. I need to be of service to God and God's kids. I need to do a 10th, 11th, and 12th step. These are super basic things. For me, that means practical stuff. I need to have a commitment. In order to have a commitment, I have to have a regular meeting. I need to honor my commitment. These are super basic things, and we call them sometimes the foundation. And what I can tell you is, my AA house is really a much bigger and lovelier house than I ever would have imagined I would get in sobriety, but it is predicated on having a solid foundation. And I can undermine the foundation of my own house, or I can take daily actions to make that foundation solid. And I mean this. I really was the kind of person when I was new, I thought it was lovely. Your stories of how you're becoming lawyers and you're becoming in relationships and yay, that's really lovely. I knew that wasn't for me. I knew that I was just a defective person. I didn't think God was ever going to do for me what he was doing for you. But you sort of tricked me into doing the things that you do. And now at 27 years, I have a business. I have a house. I have these kids. They're healthy. They're all in puberty, and so I do get my inventory told on a fairly regular basis, but they're good kids. I think I'm fortunate. And, when I started being a newcomer again, I went What I realized was this. I realized I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I had a sponsor in sort of name, but my sponsor had moved to Turkey, and this is sort of even before email. So it was a little theoretical, and I needed someone a little bit more in my life. I needed a real home group. That's what had been working for me when I was new in New York. And so I went over to the Pacific Group, and I went to Clancy to ask him to sponsor me, and I went to him for a very simple reason. I was about 9 years sober by this point. I'd been around there for a few weeks. And he sponsored a lot of people with double-digit sobriety who were enthusiastic about AA. And I was miserable and had just turned 9 years. And I knew that if I made it to double-digit sobriety and had enthusiasm for AA, I was doing better. And it wasn't more complicated or more genius than that. And so I went and I asked him to take on my case. And he looked at me, and it was July, and he goes, "Kid, you're really pale. It's good to be out in the sun enjoying life." And what that meant was he wanted me to go to the yard. It sounds like you know what the yard is. If you don't know what the yard is, we play softball and volleyball. We eat some hot dogs. It could not be more harmless and all-American and lovely unless you're me. I had no baseball skills. I was awful at baseball. It was a year before I got a hit, and I was so miserable. And newcomers would like roll out of your detox trucks and hit triples, and I wanted to cause you pain. And but I kept showing up. I kept showing up, and it was awful. Here's the kind of guy I am. I'm the kind of guy who's figured out a couple of things that I'm pretty good at. I'm good at stringing words together. It's a parlor trick, but I've got it. I know I have a few skills, and I really try to stick to my skills and avoid things that I'm bad at, because I absolutely believe you can die of shame. I believe that. And it's humiliating to not be able to play baseball, but week after week I showed up, and there was this guy, Tom. And Tom had been the coach of the women's softball team, and in the Pacific Group, he was known as being the dude who you talk to if you were afraid of playing ball. And so the old-timers, like, shipped me off to go talk to Tom, and it was the most awful thing ever, because Tom had advanced diabetes and had literally had his legs cut off with advanced diabetes, and he hadn't he was waiting to be moved out of his second-floor apartment. It was just awful, and I'm like, look, I am capable of great feats of self-obsession, but that, like, whining to a man without legs that I'm afraid of playing baseball, like, that's a lot. But they said, you gotta do it. So I go and I talk to Tom, and Tom, there are two things. Firstly, he gave me some very practical information. He just said, "Kid, for the jocks, it's just a Saturday night. It's a Saturday day. It's a way to stay out of trouble. But for people who are afraid and walk through it, it changes your life." And that was good. That was good information. But the other thing was this. What I really understood, there was something in his eyes, and I got that Tom was a man who had real problems, and that I actually was providing him with an opportunity to get out of self, that he could help another alcoholic and be less focused on his situation when he was doing that. And I had forgotten that. I'd forgotten that that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous for an alcoholic of my type, that I am crippled by alcoholic self-obsession, and the best I can hope for is to have opportunities to be of service to God and God's kids that get me out of self long enough to escape that kind of crippling self-obsession. I'd forgotten that, and I will never lose my gratitude for Tom's kind of rekindling that for me. It's time for me to finish, and I do want to say this. Tom was a member of my home group, and he actually took one more cake at our meeting on Wednesday night before he died. The diabetes was really bad, and he had gotten fitted with fake artificial legs, fake legs, whatever I would, prosthetics. Thank you very much. He'd gotten fitted with his prosthetics, and if you've never been to our Wednesday night meeting, to take a cake at the Wednesday night meeting, you go to the cake table, and then there's some stairs you walk up to get to the podium. And Tom, under his own power, took a cake from Clancy, who was also his sponsor, and then walked up to that podium and shared his gratitude. And here's what I can tell you. On that night, I saw a man who had lost his legs get up and walk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized it was a miracle. And I want to tell you this. When I realized that, I understood something. miracles didn't start happening because I had rekindled a contact with God, but that if I don't have a connection with a higher power, I don't see the miraculous nature of life. It just flies by me. What you give me is an opportunity to get connected with a higher power enough that I can appreciate how wonderful and miraculous life is. And if you're new, I mean it. It is miraculous and wonderful, and I hope you stick around long enough to see that too. Thanks. Yeah.